translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. The sage Maitreya said, "The Lord, being thus worshipped by all the great sages and transcendentalists, touched the water with His hooves and placed it on touched the earth with His hooves and placed it on the water." Please repeat. The great Maitreya said, "The Lord, being thus worshipped by all the great sages and transcendentalists, touched the earth with His hooves and placed it on the water." Purport. The earth was placed on the water by the Lord, or His inconceivable potency. The Lord is all-powerful, and therefore He can sustain the huge planets either on the water or in the air as He likes. The tiny human brain cannot conceive of how these potencies of the Lord can act. Man can give some vague explanation of the laws by which some phenomena are made possible. But actually, the tiny human brain is unable to conceive of the activities of the Lord, which are therefore called inconceivable. Yet, frog-like philosophers still try to give some imaginary explanation. Omagana Tamandashagananda Shalakaya Chakshushumilatam Dina Tasmai Sivadavina Maha Sri Chaitanya Manabhistam Stabitam Yena Bhutale Sri Rubagadamayan Tananti Bharat Kandiyam Mahajavalaya Gita Shura Gauri Govinda Swami Tanamadhi Kaula Bhakta Bhinanda Kijaya Vantikapa Thurvishcha Kripa Sindhu Yevacha Paditanam Vaishnam.
So here we have Isi Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. When was this purport written? Some maybe 65, 66, 67, 68, something like that, I think. Okay. So Srila Prabhupada is explaining here that at that time, at least, very little was understood about how it is that the Lord's potencies function. Since then, advancement by scientists have been very great. So, sometimes we condemn the scientists, but scientists are very good because they help us understand the Lord. That is their job. Every particular occupation of anyone is meant to enlighten other people. Therefore, we have the Varnashram system, starting from the intelligentsia, going all the way down. So the scientist's job is to convince us of the workings of the Lord, and Cambridge and Oxford universities originally were set up for that purpose with theological people in charge. So you remember when you went to school, I don't know if I'm older than most of you guys, we used to sing hymns before we'd start class. Did you do that? Yeah. Who did that? Yeah. So one of the hymns was, "All things bright and beautiful, all creatures great and small." You remember that song? Yeah. "All things wise and wonderful, the Lord God made them." And then it goes on, each flower that opens, each bird that sings, so on and so forth. So this is a wonderful hymn, and many hymns were like that, in glorification of God. So this is the job of the intelligentsia. Actually, those hymns were written by the Brahminical intelligentsia, you could say, right?
Because in Vedic culture there was different sorts of intelligence. There was the Brahminical intelligence, who could understand more who was Brahman. There was spiritually orientated. And then there was the Vipras, who were just scholars in various fields. They may not fully understand Brahman as such, although they know some of the workings of Brahman. But the real intelligence here, the Vaishnava Brahmins, they understood everything. So it is the job of the scientists to convince us that God is existing. But unfortunately, in Kali Yuga, they try to do the opposite. Not all of them, but some of them do. And so this is a great disservice to humanity, because when humanity is not served by the intelligentsia, it begins to form different opinions about life's directions and what kind of things we should be doing with our lives. And the real purpose of life is lost. So, for instance, Charles Darwin, when he first speculated upon his theory of, you could say, it's actually a hypothesis, but they call it a theory. He thought that in future times, everything will be clear. In time, give me time, I'm saying that this is how the energies work, but in time, science will prove me right. So, do you think the scientists have proved him right? Anyone think that they've got anywhere near proving him right? Anyone say? Many people, I think at least 60-70% of the population will say yes. But if you actually examine, nothing's really much been proved right at all. In fact, nothing at all. So, in fact, science has done a great service, because the more they look into the material energies, that's why I say when Prabhupada wrote this in the 60s and 70s, science has not really developed so much. To some extent they had, but the more the scientists have looked into matter and materiology, the more they find complexity and order. So this is a great, it should be a wake-up call, that wherever you find such complexity and such order in the material energies, in our experience at least, in a logical way, we can assume there must be an order giver. Math, symmetry, design, order is seen everywhere. How can we assume such things do not come from an orderly person who is creating such an order? Therefore, Savakarikarikaranam, the cause of all causes, is in the Vedas. So the more the scientists look into the material world, the more order and complexity they see. And when this particular purport was written, I don't think necessarily that the knowledge of the DNA codes had really come out in so much detail. Some detail was there, perhaps. So Francis Crick, he discovered these codes within the cells, and the DNA coding is within the cell, and that particular DNA coding is transforming the cell and making it into a human form. So one cell becomes two cells become three cells. Why is it doing that? because there's a code within within the cell. And the cell, this DNA code is got a little messenger. It's called an mRNA, and that code goes off into a ribosome, and the ribosome collects all the nutrients in the mother's body, and it forms the amino acids and all the other aspects, the proteins, and so on. And then the so all this system is coded, and in that way, we can see the fingerprints of God. This is what Francis Crick said. This is like seeing the fingerprints of God. So it's a wonderful thing that the intelligence can only figure out so much, as Srila Prabhupada clearly says here. But as intelligence develops, more and more you'll see the obvious order and design within the material energy. And therefore, in Nihilogic, it is said, when you see smoke on a distant mountain, right, what do you think? If you're walking on a distant mountain, you see smoke, what would you assume? You would assume there's fire, right? Hare Krishna. That's called logic, induction. Like human being has abilities, it can deduce things, and it can use logic. So looking in the material energy, one should intelligently see things in the proper perspective. The question is, if you're honest and truthful, you will see the obvious. But if you're not honest and truthful, you'll see other things. So when you see smoke in a mountain, you think there's fire. But how do you know there's fire? That's the question. And in Jiva Goswami, this Tapa Sandava, he said, how do you know there's fire? You don't know there's fire. Because you see smoke, you assume there's fire. So Jiva Goswami says, you have to find that person who has seen the fire, because the fire may have just gone out and the smoke is still rising. So therefore, further knowledge is required. So although the senses can deduce things, and it says in the Bhagavad Gita that by logic and induction, that's one way of understanding that you're not the body. Family traditions is another way, because conservatism from one generation to another generation to another generation, we're hearing from our ancestors and we're accepting their knowledge. That's one way of doing it. Always our senses, they can perceive something. But to actually understand God himself and all his workings, one requires something a bit more than one's material senses, logic. It's something beyond. Therefore, Tatsi Krishnamandina Bharagayamindriya Sivamukhi Jivanoya. You have to purify your senses, you have to become honest. An honest man sees things honestly. A crooked man, doesn't matter how much you tell him, he won't hear from you. You see that all over the world today. The whole world is under threat, you could say, of tradition. This is what this war, it's almost like a religious war going on between those that want to conserve culture and traditions and theological culture, and others that want to bring in conglomerate liberalism, and, because it's good for business.
Liberalism is very, very good for business because the more you enjoy your senses, the more money is to be made out of you. If you're a simple person, there's no money to be made out of you. You simply live in the countryside, chanting Hare Krishna, and you go and get your own food. What? You're no good to the conglomerates. They must increase your material desires. Then big business is made. And that is their business. So the current wars around the world stem around that basic idea of conglomerates, liberalism, or the traditionalists. And the traditionalists are seen as enemies, but they're not enemies. They're actually more Vedic. So some people, like for instance, he's honest. This is honesty. This is honesty, you know. Because the conglomerates and the liberalists, they are scientific, they're followers of scientific materialism, because scientific materialism fits the bill. It fits the bill of increasing industrialization and increasing wealth. Because it means that you are just a product of material energy and you should enjoy yourself to the maximum. And why not? Because you only have one life, and when you die, it's all finished. So many, many considerations have to be looked into as to why the atheistic persons develop their scientific materialistic philosophies, and who's in with it, and what are they preaching? They're dishonest people. They will not admit to themselves that there's a God. So this is dishonest. If you're dishonest or you're crooked, you will not understand God. There's no way you can understand God, because your first deceit is that you want to be an enjoyer. You don't want there to be a God. You want to be the God. Therefore, you will place God out of your mind. And you will make every endeavor in every single way to become the master and the lord of all you survey. And those around you, you will try to exploit for your own ends, either grossly or subtly. This is what's going on. So unless you become the servant of God and understand how to become a servant of God, then you remain crooked. There's different degrees of crookedness, you know, because there's mixtures of crookedness. I like God a little bit, but still I pay lip service to God. But I won't surrender my life to God entirely. I will keep something back for myself. Therefore, only in the association of a pure Vaishnava who's fully surrendered to God, you will learn such knowledge. Because he is not crooked. He is pure. He's pure, pure Vaishnava. So, to understand this is a very important point for devotees to understand, that science is helping us understand God. And the more the scientists delve into the materials, the more they see. And also one could take the matter further, because we have to preach to people, for instance. You know the algorithmic processes in your computer, right? You're on computer regularly. They have a fingerprint of you. They know who you are, what you are, they know you. They have files and files on you somewhere. I believe they're stored in some cold place somewhere in England there's massive computer banks stored. Because all this information is stored on you. Later, as AI develops, someone will get information on the AI system. They'll infiltrate the system, and they will tell anyone
anyone that pays them enough, they'll tell you about that person, what he is, what he wants, what he does. Everything about you will be known at a price. So these algorithmic processes are quite interesting because they are very similar to the divine algorithmic processes, do you think? Right? Your next body is already forming. Your next, isn't it? So Krishna knows. The material energy knows. It's as you live this life, your next body is forming. So this is described in the third canto of the Bhagavatam as well. These subtle energies. Prabhupada said this is a great science of understanding. And therefore there's hints of this in science as well, things like quantum physics, where the observer effect is thought to be quite an unusual effect, where when you look at something, it acts one way, and when you look away, it acts in a different way. So people begin to look at that and they contrive that perhaps this means that mind and matter are quite closely interlinked. And it is a fact that all God's energies are interlinked and working together as one. You know, like material energy, the spiritual energy and the marginal energy, they're all God's energies and they're interlinked and they're working together. So Krishna knows everything about you've heard that, Krishna knows everything, right? So it's like, you know, there's almost like instant communication going on, you could say. That's another thing the scientists come up with, is instant communication. That one part of the universe, miles away, knows what something is going on in. So this is similar, because it's all God's energy. So Krishna, or God, knows everything everyone's doing. So this algorithmic process, it's like a transcendental AI. Not an artificial intelligence, but supreme intelligence. But it's artificial in the sense that we have come to this world in an artificial way, so Krishna is giving you an artificial life. So this is Krishna's AI. He knows. He give you a body, give you a mind, give you intelligence to become convinced by what you have. It's like Sataputta says, what's these game machines where you put this thing on? Virtual reality machine. Sataputta said this many years ago. He was so sharp, Sataputta. You're in a virtual reality. But it's so clever that the AI systems and the algorithmic systems are so clever, they follow you around. So therefore, karma is like that. Your karma is your algorithmic footprints, and it's following you everywhere you go. So this is going on. And so modern science, although the human brain cannot understand God, as Prabhupada was saying these things in the 60s and 70s, as we go on in time, this is like 40, 50, 60 years later, actually we're beginning to understand something of the greatness of God even more, thanks to the scientists. So nevertheless, it's all very well to consider these things, and they should be considered. But the point is, if one's in the mode of ignorance, you'll never understand how Krishna's energies are working. Therefore, tadava yastamo bhava kama lava yastye chetaravadava. And with those in the mode of ignorance and passion, they can't understand. You have to come to goodness. Evam paramparapattam. Oh, what's that verse? No, I've got that here. Evam prasandamanaso bhagavat bhakti yogarap bhagavat tapa vijnanam. You develop scientific knowledge. This is what it said here. Thus established in the mode of pure goodness, whose mind is enlivened by contact of devotional service and truthfulness, then he will gain positive scientific knowledge, Prabhupada said. What is that? That scientific positive knowledge of who we are. Jivera Srubhoi Krishna Nitya Das. Like that. Tatashta Shakti. We are Tatashta Shakti. So, Lord Brahma himself, when he first, by the way, this particular chapter of Varaha is describing how the earth planet was situated in the water, wasn't it? Right? The earth planet, what's it doing in the water? You know how it got there? Yeah, but there's two explanations of the way of why this Leela takes place. Sadaputta Prabhu, who knows so many things, he says. Not just this, Varaha comes, that's one Varaha, but Varaha comes in other times as well. Because at the end of the devastation, at the end of Lord Brahma's life, what happens to the earth? It becomes inundated and it's situated below the waters. So when Brahma wakes up again, that planet has to be moved back up to where it should be. So every 4.5 billion years, there is a partial devastation. So the earth planet is inundated with the waters. And so Varaha or other incarnation of God, place it back into the water. Here we see this Leela taking place. So because Lord Brahma is currently halfway through his life, 50 years old, I think, is something like that. And I think that the Brahma's day is about halfway through as well. So his life is halfway through and his day is halfway through. So we've got another 2 billion years before that next devastation takes place. So throughout Lord Brahma's life, different time periods are coming and going. So this whole business of, like Lord Brahma, he originally needed knowledge. He needed information because he was on the lotus petal and there was all darkness. He didn't know who he was, where he came from. So he prayed to Krishna and did austerity. And then after a period of time, he heard the word tapa, and then he became enlivened by Krishna. So this is the point. That you have to do some austerity and you have to become truthful and you have to want to know. Those that want to know will know. God will tell you. God will show you. God will give you light if you're truthful. If you really want something, Krishna will give it to you. Therefore, Brahmananda Brahmati Kona Bhagavandi Guru Krishna Bhachai Bhakti. Wandering all over the universe. Then he meets the devotee because he wants to know. When you want to know, Krishna, he wants to know, I will send my devotee. Depends what you want to know. And Janeshwara Chudashwara, some people want to know something of God. But they also want to know, like the Vedas, going back to Lord Brahma when he was enlivened, he was given information. And therefore he spoke the Vedas. Each one of his four heads, different Veda came. Sama Veda, Rig Veda, Yajna Veda, Atharva Veda came. And also the Itihashtras and the Puranas were spoken by all four heads. These Itihashtras and Puranas are very helpful. They're essential for us because Jiva Goswami says that the Vedas are too complicated in this. We cannot possibly understand the ins and outs of the Vedas. They're too complicated. So therefore, he's made it simpler in terms of the Puranas and the Itihastra. Itihastra means it was like this. It was like, you know, it's like a storyline, the Mahabharata, similar. So the Srimad Bhagavatam contains the Itihastras, the Puranas, and the four Vedas. So it's summarized. Everything is summarized nicely. And therefore, you'll see when we read the Bhagavatam, all these kind of sacrifices going along. You know, everything you'll find in the Rig Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda, and Sama Veda, you'll find in the Bhagavatam. But interestingly enough, when Jajan Mahaprabhu was speaking to Ramananda Roy, it's like he was going for the Bhagavatam. Yeah. Yes, that's very nice. Is there something more? Yes, that's very nice. Is there something more? Yes, that's nice. He was like rushing through the Bhagavatam and coming to the 10th canto, you could say. Mahaprabhu was like that. So he's come to teach us something special. Not that we don't want to understand all the Bhagavatam, because we have to progress on in our lives, and all the Vedas are useful, and the Puranas are useful. There's 18 Puranas, and these Puranas are specially meant for the intelligentsia and management of the universe. This is what the Puranas are meant for, that the theological priests and the kings need to understand how they function and how they should be placed into society so society could be guided. That is the point of the Itihasas and the Puranas. But ultimately, we need to get to what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has given, which is the culmination of the Bhagavatam, which is given in the 10th canto. Krishna's Leela, the real essence of everything is given there. Not only of the 10th canto, but also other shastra, other things that Mahaprabhu would hear from. He would hear from the Gita Govinda, or Chandidasa's work, or Bilva Mangal Thakur. He would hear all these Leelas. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was teaching us something very special. Because as one advances in his spiritual life, he will inevitably and irresistibly become attracted to Krishna in different ways. Because Krishna has his dear Lalita form, his dear Datta form, dear Prashant, and dear Odada. So, you know, when Krishna speaks with Arjuna and Yudhisthira and with Queen Kunti, Dira Prashant. That's his Dira Prashant form when he's dealing with Yudhisthira and others. It's a very formal, like Vaikuntha, you know, in Dwarka. In Dwarka, Krishna's in a different mood there. So he's with his queens, he's with the Brahmins, he's giving charity, he's acting perfectly in so many wonderful ways. He's smiling at the Brahmins and he's discussing philosophy with them or whatever. When he's chastising Indra, that is his dear Datta form, but he's also very compassionate. Krishna is always compassionate with any condition he's in. Like when he sees Queen Kunti, when Queen Kunti gives her prayers, Krishna mildly smiles at her. Because he's a very blissful, loving person. So he has to reciprocate in different ways with different persons. And of course, when he's in Vrindavan, he's in Dira Datta form. That's a completely different
aspect of Krishna, and therefore that's called Ragatmaka, the Ragatmaka devotees. They're following Krishna in the village of Vrindavan. So Krishna has all these wonderful aspects to his personality. So Lord Brahma, he, as the chief engineer of the universe, he acquired this knowledge through sacrifice and through meditation. And so one who is sincerely looking for truth, he will find that same truth. The Brahma Gayatri is like that. The first line of the Brahma Gayatri is like you're acquiring knowledge, like Lord Brahma, you could say. Who am I? What am I? And also, you remember Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Sanatana Goswami's first meeting? Chaitanya, what did Sanatana Goswami say? He said, who am I? What am I? Why am I suffering? This is what the first intelligent question of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So this is the real essence of life, too. To understand one's condition. So the scientists, when we become convinced of what they're saying, that there's order, there must be some order supplier, that therefore, okay, if that's the case, what are we doing here? What is the purpose of life? There must be a God. Who is God? What does God do? And then other questions like that can be answered. And one essential element to Krishna consciousness is that whenever you look into the world, you can't deny the beauty of the material world. Everything in the world that you see out there, whether it be relationships with brothers, sisters, lovers, mothers, it's all there. You can't shut your eyes to it. You can't shut your eyes to it. You have to understand this is a tinge of beauty. It's a tinge, it's a reflection of a reality. This is our philosophy. For instance, when you go past a school, let's say a secondary school, at 3:30 in the afternoon, what do you see? School's out. Now, 13, 14, 15-year-old, what are they like? My God, they're enlivened. They're full of joy. They're full of happiness. They're very enthusiastic for life. There's this girl, there's that boy, there's this one, there's that, isn't it? Isn't it? You can't deny it. This is what's going on. So you'll find in your life, from your childhood all the way to your, this is a reflection of the spiritual energy. Krishna's giving you a taste. You like this age? Would you like this age? Would you like this age? Do you like this type of relationship? Or do you? And actually it goes further, because in the spiritual world there's many species of life. Perhaps that's why we have to go through the many species of life. We might like to be a bird. I was sitting in my room the other day looking at this bird on the top of the tree. Now, if we, as devotees, do not relate to that bird, and I'm talking about really feel for that bird, if you feel for that bird the way you feel for your family, then you're coming close to Parabhuta Parasanatmana Sochiki, isn't it? Is it true? If you just see a bird flying and you just... This is not Brahmabhuta Prasanatma. Any living entity you see, you must feel for. This is Krishna consciousness. And therefore, one time Srila Prabhupada was, his disciples were watching him, he was watching ants. It's a fact. Any living entity you see, whether it be a dog, cat, bird, pigeon, butterfly flying from them, how can you ignore that butterfly? You think that butterfly is no one? Why, are you ignoring the butterfly? No. What do you feel for that butterfly?
It's a being. It's in, what's it doing? It's in looking to enjoy. So the real Brahmabhuta Parasanatma, the real Vaishnava, he has such a heart that he is connected to all living beings. So we cannot be academic about this. We must have feelings for it. So now these feelings are greatly, you could say, magnified to unlimitedly with the soul, because the soul has emotions. Our soul is covered by this body. We have a little fraction of emotions, isn't it? Little fraction of emotions. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he chants the holy name or the pure Vaishnava, all the soul is full of emotions. They all come out. Therefore, weeping, Mahaprabhu's body was, this is the spiritual emotions. So here we see something that is a reflection of it, some enthusiasm to enjoy life. So these Shankaracharya followers, the impersonalists, they're the greatest, they do the greatest harm. Because they tell you, ignore, just make it one. Where the Vaishnavas, we say, no, to see the beauty of this woman, to see the beauty of this young man, to see the beauty of the mother, of the beauty. We look at the beauty and we face it and we take it head on. Even we take we take life so head on that we'll even take on conjugal mellows of the material world. We're not frightened to take on the conjugal mellows in the material world. We're not going to be shutting our eyes to it. Therefore, Vigviridam Vaja Vajabiritam Sri Vishnu, that verse is there. So, there's two verses that work together. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they're like, although they're one and the same, they're totally different. And Vigviridam Vaja Vajabiritam Sri Vishnu, if you want to become purified of all lust, rigrogam, hridrogam, the lust in the heart is purified when you understand the wonderful activities of Krishna, the supreme enjoyer, the supreme autocrat in the land of Raj. But his activities are eternal. So it's pure love. Just like we were discussing the butterfly, for Krishna is pure love. Forever he's with his damsels of Raj. They're not some playthings for his, senses, his spirit. He's fully committed to them. He's enjoying every aspect of their consciousness and life forever and increasing. There's no comparison to the material world, but the material world, there's a slight, it appears like it's the same, but it's not, because the spiritual emotions and the love is not there. It's just the lust is there. So there's another verse. What's that? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's verse. I got it written because I know that verse, but I forgot for one second. This is the last thing I'll say before. It's a very important verse. I'll just try to find it. just hum to yourself while. Or try to get. Anyway, I can't find it. It's the verse where Mahaprabhu is telling that it's like poison. What's it? You know that? It's like poison. If you see a man with a woman, it's like poison. Niskinchina Bhagavan Bhajam Mokusha Paramparam Jigamashuri Sangara Shadashanam Vishayam Ostam Cha Hunter Hunter Piyakshatru, something like that. This is saying that it's like poison. If you see a man enjoying with a woman or in this life, if you're conscious, this is like poison to your spiritual consciousness. At the same time, we have Rikviridam Vajavajaviratam Shivishnu. It's telling us,
You should concentrate on this if you want. So it's strange, isn't it? You got one verse saying, Dharma Shagravaga is saying, don't look at this, don't enter into that topic. Another verse says, enter into that topic, because that's a solution to your, isn't it? Anyway, we better wrap up, I think, right now. So if anyone have any realizations on this verse at all, or any thoughts on the matter, yes, we'll go.
Thank you for your scientific class. Just just occurred to me when you were referencing the Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma verse and
butterfly mud.
Yes, it just reminded me of a conversation with Srila Prabhupada and his disciples where they speak about Saint Francis of Assisi and how he saw every living entity, all the birds and beasts and so on, as brothers and sisters.
Yes.
And Prabhupada said, that is Paramatma realization. So he was saying he was Paramatma realized.
Yeah, that's it.
It's beautiful. I have a question.
I love the Christians, I really.
Yeah.
I would do. I also like Hildegard. Does anyone know Hildegard von Bingen? She's a fantastic saintly person. My God. He's proudly speaking, it's like Bhagavatam hearing her stuff. So if you ever get a chance, look up Hildegard von Bingen. She's an 11th century nun. Anyway, yeah.
Sorry, I just have a question as well. So the majority of the scientific community still dismiss the idea of intelligent design. You know, they say life and the universe is all the product of undirected material processes.
Yeah.
But every scientific invention ever made was designed by an intelligence. So do they actually have any example of an unintelligent design, aside from, you know, the universe, which is of course the most complex design, and life itself? It doesn't make any sense, does it?
It doesn't make sense at all. It's kind of puzzling. And that's why we were saying, you know, they're dishonest, they're crooked. Therefore, they can't see the obvious, because design. In fact, you know, Richard Dawkins, he says in his book, you will see design everywhere, but ignore it. That's what he says. Ignore it. Because if you don't ignore it, you'll think there's God. I'm not joking, that's what he says. This is how. They will never accept the obvious because they're crooked. They're demons, actually. But fortunately, there's the Discovery Institute, which is like the Bhaktivedanta Institute. So these two institutes are working very well, and they are full of PhD scientists that are theists. And people like Dr. James Torr, he's a brilliant chemist. He's a synthetic chemist himself. And he'll tell you how difficult it is to combine chemicals. Because if you get into mutational process, before the mutational process, you got the primordial soup. Well, how do chemicals bind? It's not so easy to get chemicals to bind together. They don't bind together. Like, for instance, everything in life is the left hand. You know, molecules have, they're chiral, like our two hands, right? You've got a left and a right. If you hold up your left hand in the mirror, you'll see your right hand. So molecules are chiral, but they only choose the left hand side to form bonds with other chemicals. It's like, you can't put your left hand in your right glove. So similarly, all the molecules in life are left-handed, but all the sugars and the carbohydrates are right-handed. So James Torr says, why is that? And mixed chemicals, like Prabhupada used to say, mixed chemicals make life. They can't. It's very, very difficult to mix chemicals. They tried to make artificial RNA. They've got it to 5% purity. But you require 100% purity. And to get RNA to 100% purity, you have to heat it, cool it, take it off, add this, add that.
If you don't do the proper procedures, it all breaks down. So unless chemicals are perfectly bonded, they simply dissipate. So regarding the primordial soup and the chemicals coming together, even before the mutational process, it's a non-starter. But yet, they'll say in their big papers, and they'll cite, they cite their papers, right? You have to cite various scholars, and then your paper becomes bona fide. Like they've got these, a professor, they got PhDs, falling out their pockets. They're so academic. They're so strong. But I made a post yesterday, actually, that struck me. You remember that story of the king and his clothes? Right? Yeah. The tailor came and he pretended to give him a nice set of clothes. Can't you see how beautiful it is? And the king thought, yes, and he's walking around. And then someone said, hey, you've got no clothes on. So similarly, these scientists, they all these but someone, and Prabhupada says this, the layman, like I'm a layman, I'm not a trained scientist, I'm a layman. I'll go and say, well, hold on. And then you say, you have all these PhDs, but are you speaking about objective, is this objective truth? Or is this a subjective opinion about how you see the world? So ultimately, it is simply subjective opinions and guessing. But they're walking around with these clothes that everyone considers to be knowledge, but it's not knowledge. Yes, Guru.
Hare Krishna, Prabhupada.
Last question.
Guruji, thank you. Wonderful class, beautiful scientific presentation. Wonderful.
Well, it wasn't that good, but anyway, thank you for your encouragement.
I'm studying at the Cambridge University data science at the moment.
There we are. Here's a scientist for you.
Now, can you help me here? Vedanta, do we have four levels of cognition, right? The second level would be manas. The third level would be buddhi. And the fourth level would be atma. Can you help me unpack this?
Say that again.
The second level would be manas, which is mind.
Right.
The third level would be buddhi, am I right? And the fourth level would be atma. Now, what I'm trying to do is to get an understanding of where artificial intelligence is. Is it in manas coming into a little bit buddhi? And we'll never reach atma, obviously, because it's connected to paramatma. Can you help me unpack this a little?
Yeah. The artificial intelligence, I wrote on this just a couple of years ago, it's a bunch of geeks and intellectuals who are trying to change culture. Ultimately, it comes from America, a lot of this stuff. It comes from America, and it's flooding the world. And it's really, if you have a look it's simply one geek or an intellectual who is putting his stuff out there. And, it's not true knowledge. In that sense, that's basically, and the goal is to change cultures and to influence people to start thinking the way we think and start intellectualizing the way we intellectualize. That's basically what AI is.
I'd like to take this up with you later, maybe, if that's possible.
So Buddhi Yoga is the yoga of intelligence. That's the transcendental intelligence which is bestowed upon the living being. So that Buddha yoga is superior to the ordinary intellect. That is, tesam satatam yuktanam bhaji. I will give you the intelligence to see. You know what we were saying, that the spirit soul is in every single body? The consciousness, if you can see the same consciousness in every body, and you have the same respect for every body, that is Buddhi yoga.
Yes.
That Buddhi yoga can never be acquired through artificial intelligence. It's given by God.
So yeah, exactly.
So that type of thing.
This is the point that
but
I've been making.
If you have, I was discussing it with you, if you have, in fact, I was talking to some devotees in America and I said a couple of years ago that AI could be useful if it's run by Vaishnavas. Do you think?
That's why I'm studying it.
Yeah, because I'm thinking that, for instance, AI would work like this, that you something comes up on your phone and it is telling you to do something with your life. But then the AI Vaishnava said, no, if you do this, this will be the consequence. Look out for that, because if you act like that, that could occur in your future karmic situation. So you could add transcendental AI by warning people how to, what the consequences of their actions would be. So in that sense, it could be of some use.
Thank you, Prabhuji, thank you.
Hare Krishna.
If I could take this up with you.
Yes, yeah.
Offline. Yeah.
That'd
Thank
be
you.
Very good. I can give you my email and so on. Thank you very much, Hare Krishna.